Podcasts of Homegrown are made possible thanks to support from listeners like you. Consider becoming a member of WFPL by calling 502-814-6565 or at the website wfpl.org. Thanks. Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
With Bob Hill.
And very good show today.
Of course.
Tulip poplars was one of those trees that we didn't have one, and, you know, we've got a everything, yeah. One of everything. Andy's like a tree planting maniac.
Do you go, Andy?
And that was on his number one list of this is, you know, what we have to plant in 2010. Yeah. So.
And he did it.
So
that's my guy.
That's right. I look forward to it becoming this big, beautiful, stately tree that it will become. And we're going to find out more about the tulip poplar with Deborah Hill.
Lady named Deborah Hill, no relation, because she knows much more than I do about anything.
She's pretty cool.
It would seem to be. But yeah, we're going to talk about the tulip poplar and then kind of run off in a different direction with that. She also does a lot of work in what she calls agroforestry, which mm-hmm. is people who own small lots of trees, raising shiitake mushrooms or Christmas trees or things like that.
It's
an economic venture beyond the woodland management.
Yeah, making it do something while it's growing.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then potentially harvest it or do other things. It's pretty interesting stuff. So,
yeah, it really is.
And she's been around for a long time.
Yeah.
So she knows the area and is pretty...
very enthusiastic about what she's doing.
Perfectly put.
Yes.
And the world-famous, fabulous plantsman, Alan Armitage. We love Alan Armitage.
Yeah, he runs off madly in all directions at the same time, and he's very enthusiastic about his work. And
his books are great because they're not like dry, here, this perennial, that vine, this whatever.
Yeah.
He is... You know him through his writing.
Yeah,
you know, he tells you anecdotal stories about the plants, and he's experienced them all. So his books are always informative, but also interesting, you know, reads because it's not dry.
Yeah, this one's on vines and climbers. Mm-hmm. And you might get a pencil and paper, dear listeners, because we're going to throw a lot of names at you in a hurry. And there's a lot of cool vines coming your way, but Alan
really
will speak in a hurry.
Yeah, he will. He's enthusiastic.
Yeah, so, but it's worth listening to.
Absolutely. So, coming up today on Homegrown, we hope that you'll stick with us. Bob, what's going on in your garden?
A mild experiment. I planted a bunch of tulips last fall, and they all just look gorgeous. But I planted some deliberately about 6 inches deeper than normal, hoping they'd come on later.
Yeah, and they should.
I'm about to send in some oxygen. I'm not sure.
Oh.
No, they're slowly emerging, so it seems to be working.
Uh-huh. I think that's the recommendation.
Yeah, I went really deep, so I'll report back in a couple weeks
on
the source, because you do want your tulips kind of in a parade.
Sure.
And right now I've got the lead marching drummer.
Okay.
I'm waiting for the backup crew.
Waiting for the tardy ones.
Are they ever? But yeah. The other thing is I'm growing a white redbud.
Okay.
Which is really an interesting plant.
You put it next to the
you put it next to one of the Appalachian red buds or the regular red buds. Here's this white red bud. It makes an interesting
it's
a showstopper.
Uh-huh.
It just stops people. So I'm just saying try white redbud in your lives, folks.
It's hard to say somehow.
Apparently. How about the wishes thing? What's up?
It's so funny. Back when we moved out to Shelby County in 1979, there used to be tons of killdeer birds, you know? And for a while, Daddy even toyed with calling the farm killdeer. Because everywhere running along the pond. They'd make nests in the middle of our gravel driveway.
Whoa.
So just this
year.
That's
why there's no more killdeer. Yeah,
well, it kind of speaks to the fact that it's been so developed out there. That's why there's no more killdeer. Nobody has gravel driveways anymore either.
Right.
But that's not the only place they'd go. But guess there's a nest in the vegetable garden in the wood chips.
Oh, yeah.
And Bob, it is so funny because you go back there and you know there's a nest, but it took Andy and I literally 2 days of searching to actually find it.
Wow.
And I finally found it the other day, and it was basically because the mama just goes berserk. And the more berserk she goes, the closer, you know, you were getting to it. And then I finally located it. And then basically what I wanted to do was mark it off a little bit so we wouldn't actually accidentally step on it. But the cool thing is, as soon as you come into the garden, Papa flies off, and then Mama is, you know, she acts like she's injured.
Yeah.
So she's screaming at you, but then she's also like pretty much falling down on the ground with her wing up, acting like she's injured so that you'll come and attack her and eat her.
Leave the babies alone.
And then she can fly off, but to leave the babies alone.
You go,
so
Mama.
We're trying, you know, little by little, she's doesn't get as nervous when we enter as long as we don't come into that zone. but it is a fascinating, you know, thing to watch unfold, this whole orchestration of the mama and the papa and how they protect their nest.
You wonder about the evolution of that, mm-hmm. and how in the world, over how many thousands or millions of years, that mm-hmm. they learned to do that.
Right, and why would they, in fact, pick such a seemingly vulnerable place to lay their eggs? Yeah. They basically just scooch around in gravel or in the wood chips, you know, in this instance, and create their nest, lay their eggs, four beautiful eggs. But yeah, they lay in a vulnerable place, but then they have to adapt in other ways to sort of protect it.
That's funny. I always wonder why people live in houses along I-65, too.
Uh-huh. Yeah, exactly.
Why would you want a house next to a nine-lane highway? Uh-huh. What are they thinking?
I know. So, yeah, it's pretty cool. We like our little killdeer family back there, but they sure do make a lot of noise.
Oh, yeah, but nice noise.
Yes, nice noise. All right, there are some events coming up that might interest you if you're a gardener. The Cincinnati Flower Show is going to have their run from April 17th to April 25th. It's at Symes Township Park. Cincinnati, of course, isn't too far up I-71, so you might want to check that out. I'm going to be at the Henry County Library Saturday, the 24th at 2 p.m. talking about home vegetable gardening.
Are you going to return your overdue books?
I will.
They're waiting for you.
I will, except they wouldn't be at Henry County. They'd be at Shelby County.
Okay.
So, but I'll be at Henry County.
Right.
I love the library experience.
It's a neat little town.
Yeah. And out that way, sort of, in Oldham County, Udell's got something going on.
Yep. Saturday, April 24th from 10 to 4 p.m. and Sunday, April 25th from 11 to 4 p.m. It's their annual plant sale, 8th annual, and garden market. And they have some great stuff out there. They really do. And the Louisville Bonsai Club will be there showing things off and activities for the kids. So it's always it's a great place to visit and some really neat plants.
Mm-hmm. There's also going to be a fundraiser held out at Farmington for the Historic Homes Foundation, Bob. John Karloftis will be there, but it's their annual. They've done this for a couple of years, their annual Derby breakfast. So May 1st at Farmington, you might want to check that out as well.
Down the stretch they come. We're talking Derby again.
That's
wow.
right. It's springtime in Kentucky.
Yep.
Okay, on to the tulip poplar, another sort of fabulous thing that marks Kentucky, don't you think?
Oh, yeah, and Indiana.
Yeah.
It's the state tree of Indiana and I think Tennessee.
And Kentucky.
I think Rhode Island wants in too, but they can't. That's enough, yeah. We have the perfect guest. It's Deborah Hill. Great name. She's extension professor at the University of Kentucky's Department of Forestry. She's going to talk about the tulip poplar tree, but beyond that, she's done a lot of work with agroforestry, which she will explain in a moment. Deborah, welcome to Homegrown.
Thank you.
Let's talk some first about Deborah. I mean, you spent 29 years doing this kind of stuff. Kind of give us some background on yourself and how and why you do all this.
Well, actually, I'm a sort of a standard, traditionally trained forester. My PhD is in silviculture. So I was interested in managing whole forests, and mm-hmm. I came to Kentucky in 1981, and I heard all my colleagues talking about timber harvesting, and I started looking at the demographics of who owns forests in the state of Kentucky, and found out that we've got a whole bunch of people who own forests. That is like 500,000 people who own forests
wow.
in Kentucky, and most of them own little patches like 25 acres, 10 acres. My own little farm in Frankfurt has probably less than 5 acres of forest land on it. And I thought, why are we only talking about timber harvesting? We can't do that on little areas of land. So I started looking into the whole rather broad field of what has been called alternative forest products, special forest products, and non-timber forest products.
And what does that mean to the non-forestry person?
Well, it means we're not looking at timber. We're looking at little things that grow on the ground, like spring flowers,
okay.
or we're looking at pine straw, or we're looking at maple syrup, or mushrooms, or medicinal plants, or raising bees near forests, because there are certain flowering trees that are famous for their honey, mm-hmm. like, well, poplar, actually, is one of them, but... Sourwood and Tupelo are well known for specialty honeys and trees of flowering plants. Bees like them. So.
Yeah. Well, let's back up a bit to the tulip poplar and cover that because it is the Kentucky state tree. I believe the Indiana state tree and maybe Tennessee.
It's popular.
Yeah. Give us a why is that?
Popular as
yeah.
word.
Yes. Give us a sense of history of the tree and how big it was when the first settlers came and all
well,
that.
It was really big when the first settlers came. It is native to Kentucky. It's native primarily to the northeast, but this area, you know, if you take the northeast quadrant of the United States, but it's really sort of the Ohio Valley that it is most prevalent in, and in Lucy Brown's, you know, mixed mesophytic forest, it was a significant part. But when people came originally, they probably found trees that were almost 200 feet tall and 10 feet in diameter.
Wow.
So these were big trees. It was probably in its way as important, well, as a timber tree, it was probably as important in the mixed mesophytic forest in the 1900s, 1800s, as American chestnut was.
Yeah.
Well, although it didn't provide food.
Mm-hmm. The size of it, for one, you could get a lot of timber out of it.
Right.
But is it a really hard wood?
Mm-mm. That is something that it isn't. It's one of the quote-unquote softer hardwoods. It's a less dense wood than, say, oaks or hickories.
Mm-hmm. Does it have any other, like, you know, slow to rot or insect resistant, you know, where it would have been valuable?
But the younger trees don't.
Okay.
Oh.
And they are susceptible to all kinds of kind of ordinary things.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to, like, Dutch elm disease for the elms, or the fast-approaching emerald ash borer for the ashes.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing that's devastating like that for the tulip poplar. And the other thing is that it grows very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So if there are things that attack trees when they're very young, this is not so much of a problem for the poplars because they grow so fast. They can grow 10 feet in a year.
Wow. So Deborah, like, give our listeners, because quite frankly, I don't think people know tulip poplars as well as
they should,
right? So, and if I could just tell you all a story, literally like a face-to-face encounter with a tulip poplar, you know, a humongous one, is on the school grounds of Barrett Middle School.
Mm-hmm.
And the school is built into a very steep slope.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're standing on the porch part, you basically look directly at the canopy of the tree.
Oh, wow.
And it's a huge tree.
Yeah.
So that's what I mean, like a face-to-face encounter with this very old, humongous tulip poplar. And the blooms.
Yeah, I was going to say, was it in flower?
Oh, my Lord. It was just amazing. And
yeah.
we usually don't get to be that face-to-face with that.
Right, because they're usually 30 feet over your head.
Exactly. Yeah. It was amazing. I fell in love instantly.
Yeah. It's called tulip poplar or tulip tree for that very reason, is that they really do look like tulip blooms, and they're about the same size. I mean, they're huge.
So
they're actually in the magnolia family is what's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's one of two in liriodendrons in the magnolia family.
Hmm.
One is ours, and the other is a Chinese native.
Ah.
So, okay, going back to before my story, give our listeners an idea of what a tulip poplar
would look like
okay, in its glory.
One of their greatest advantages is that they grow tall and straight. I have an anomaly outside my patio at home that's got a real curve in it, but it must have been ice damaged when it was a young tree or something, because their normal state is to grow tall and straight. And it's a grayish bark that's kind of unremarkable until they get some age on them. And then it's kind of like ski slopes. You've got these gray, wavy lines, ridges down the bark, and then white patches in between, and it can be chalky white.
Mm-hmm.
So they're really rather attractive in the bark itself. And then, of course, it's one of the... My tulip poplar outside my patio is already leafing out. So it's one of the earliest trees to leaf out, and you get that blush of pale green on hillsides. Also, the young trees tend to have kind of a conical canopy, so that, in eastern Kentucky, if you look at a hillside, you'd see all these sort of pointed trees with this blush of pale green as they begin to come out. The buds over the winter, I've said look like a bishop's mitre or like folded hands. You know, they're pointed at the top, and they have these two sides that fold together, like if you folded your hands in prayer.
Mm-hmm.
So, and those are usually reddish in the wintertime. So there's even a little bit of color during the winter, and then in the fall when they change color, they almost always go a pale golden yellow. Uniformly, it's not like a maple where you can have variegated color in the crown. It's pretty much one color, but it's a very pretty color. So they're really neat. Now, one of the things that is very important is for the homeowner, this is not for the faint of heart. It's going to be a big tree. Mm-hmm.
Right.
So if you have, you know, a little patch in front of the house, you do not want to put a tulip poplar on there. But if you've got a half-acre yard or something like that, mm-hmm. Or larger, mm-hmm. by all means plant them. Because they throw a lot of shade because they're big leaves.
So, and what about the bloom? Can you describe how magnificent the bloom is?
The bloom is orange-yellow. Mm-hmm. I think some of the petals are orange and some are yellow. And it's cup-shaped like a tulip. And they, you know, they'll occur all over the crown of the tree. And then they form the seeds inside. And the seed pod has, in the past, been confused for people who don't know trees as a pine cone because mm-hmm. their samara is like the winged seed of a maple is a samara, too. So it's got the seed at the tip and then this long, slender, very lightweight thing that will help it to be wind-borne. Mm-hmm. But they're clustered together upright in what looks like a cone. And those occur, they form in the center of the blossom. So in the wintertime, when the leaves are off the tree, you'll see these upright cone-like structures that are the seed pods. And you get a good wind or ice or something like that, and they break off and fall apart and go off on the wind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it is the Kentucky state tree and the Indiana state tree. And the Kentucky story is kind of interesting. Are you familiar with it, how it was?
Since I have been here, it has been in and out of favor
exactly.
as the state tree. So I do not know what the original impetus was, except for the fact that it was a highly valued tree that is very much a Kentucky tree. Mm-hmm. But then they switched to Kentucky coffee tree because it actually says Kentucky in its name.
Exactly, yeah.
And then they decided, no, we really want tulip poplar. Mm-hmm. And, of course, that's on all the Division of Forestry vehicles is a tulip poplar leaf. And poor old Kentucky coffee tree has been relegated to the, yeah. the state history tree or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, well, there was a legendary Courier Journal columnist named Joe Creason who wrote a tongue-in-cheek column saying, why isn't the Kentucky coffee tree the state tree? And Kentucky legislature being what it is, they all went nuts over this. And they were hopelessly divided like they were trying to pass a budget or something.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, so in 76 it was the tulip poplar. In 94 they fooled around with the Kentucky coffee tree. And then they come back again and made it the tulip poplar again, and that's what it is. So, mm-hmm.
So Bob has spoken,
right?
And so is the legislator,
yeah.
legislature.
So that's the history.
That's the history.
Let's go on now to your other interest, or really your major interest, about the agroforestry business, you call it, and the many things that these small plots can be used for besides growing trees.
Right, and agroforestry is much broader than what I've been talking about. What I do is sometimes called forest farming within agroforestry and compared to the other things which are riparian buffer strips protecting moving waterways or windbreaks that are fairly obvious of what they protect and just planting rows of trees in your fields to give some wind protection and to provide a long-term crop. Mm-hmm. The thing about agroforestry is we're all dealing with things that are highly sustainable. And let's see, there's one of them that I'm missing in there somewhere. Silvopasture, how could I forget? which is the three-way, because you've got a tree crop, you've got a forage crop, and you've got a livestock crop. Mm-hmm. And all of these tend to work together to make a more sustainable system, and also, as far as silvopasture is concerned, they have done the research, and they know that the animals are far healthier if they're in a silvopasture system than if they're just out in an open pasture.
Now, do you or UK teach classes in, like, raising shiitake mushrooms or small woodlot management, or how do people get involved?
Well, I am a 100% extension person, so I am out and about. And as a matter of fact, I will be in Louisville tonight teaching some aspiring farmers about this very thing.
Uh-huh.
And I do workshops in shiitake production. Most of my workshops, all of them, if I have any say, are hands-on. So we actually drill logs and fill them with the spawn to make shiitake mushrooms. So that's something that has definitely gained a lot of attention and interest. And in the time that I've been working with it for probably 20 years at this point, but I would say in the last 5 to 10 years, it has become mainstream. In other words, you walk into Kroger's, you walk into any of the other big supermarkets, and you'll probably find shiitake mushrooms in their mushroom section.
Mm-hmm.
I favor growing them on natural logs because I'm a forester and I would like to see people do some timber stand improvement or other management like weeding mm-hmm. in their forests. And so you can use some of this smaller material that's never going to have economic value in the timber market to grow shiitake mushrooms. So
Deborah, how does it work then? Would they be selling, you know, snags or cleaning up certain old timber?
No.
Or they would be doing it in place?
My comment is that shiitake likes fresh meat. So you need to have living trees that are living and healthy. You don't want them with lots of bumps and bruises and big holes and things like that. You want good, healthy, mini timber trees, because you're looking at things that are 8 inches or less in diameter.
So the timber
usually
stays
3 to 6 inches is good.
Uh-huh. So the timber stays in place?
No.
Okay.
You have to cut these babies down, but then you have to get the what is called spawn, which is the mushroom, the active ingredient. It's the spores mixed with sawdust, usually, or with dowel pieces to activate them. And then you drill holes through the bark of this freshly cut living tree that is now dead because it's been cut down, and you inoculate. It's called inoculation. You put these into, you drill holes, and you put this stuff into the holes and seal it off. And then you wait. And usually you wait 6 months or so for the fungus to take over the log. Mm-hmm. And then when it's done that, the fungus is the organism and the mushrooms are its fruit. So once it's taken over the log, then it can fruit. And then you grow mushrooms and they come out very quickly, within a week usually. Once you've persuaded them that it's time to do something, you do that by soaking usually. And you cut them off and you take them to market. Now, meanwhile, in that 6 months that you've been waiting for them to grow, you have organized your market. And you know if you're going to do restaurants, what restaurants you're going to. If you're doing a community-supported agriculture, you know your clients for that. If you're going to do a farmer's market, you know when that opens and when you're going to have a stand available or when you can work with somebody who already has a stand to sell your mushrooms.
What are some other products you work with the small landowners that they can make some extra money?
Well, I've got a laundry list of things, many of which I mentioned earlier. Medicinal plants is the second probably largest income-generating one.
And can you give us some examples?
And certainly ginseng is the biggie, but it takes 10 years to get really good roots on it, and it really should be grown in a natural setting. And, of course, life being what it is in Kentucky, especially in eastern Kentucky, it has a very bad habit of disappearing when it's about ready to be harvested.
Yeah.
So I do not recommend people trying to grow it unless they really can keep it under control, because the danger of losing the crop is too great. But this golden seal, which has a good market value, and there's a whole bunch of others. You go into Kmart or you go into Kroger and look at where they have vitamins and supplements and things like that, and you will find things that have black cohosh and blue cohosh and bloodroot and ginseng and golden seal and, you know, a whole bunch of other native herbs in them, and they grow in our forests. And the catch for people is that they need to know how to identify these things and then how to manage them. And a lot of managing them is giving them space. You know, if they're crowded by something else, take the something else out and let them occupy the space. If they need a little light and they're heavily shaded, take some of the branches off or something out that will allow sunlight to come in and help them. Some of them probably could be grown, in other words, this is true of the spring flowers, too, is you can dig some of them up from a patch and transplant them into a bed that you've filled with, you know, a lot of leaf mulch and stuff like that that would be similar to the forest floor. A lot of these things propagate by root division or layering. And so you give them a place to grow and they'll just spread like irises or daffodils or things that we're familiar with, that just you plant one and the next thing you know you get a gazillion of them.
Right. You have to be careful with endangered plant there, I'm sure, though.
Well, this is why I recommend that people only take part of a patch that they find and leave the rest. Probably not more than 30% of a patch of something that you find. And I would stay away from lady slippers and things like that tend to be the more endangered ones. But the ones I mentioned earlier are pretty prolific and not likely to be disappearing anytime soon.
So can you describe to the silva pasturing? Because that, to me, seems so logical, and I always was sort of confused why cows and other animals were out in a big field in full sun and never had any trees.
Well, there are a couple of things. It can be done several ways. And what I have done by my observations in Kentucky and knowing that the cattle people are moving toward rotational grazing is that if you already have areas that are sectioned off relatively permanently with fencing, then plant trees along the fence line. And they can be anything. I mean, you can grow Christmas trees, you can grow fruit trees as long as they're not black cherry. You can grow timber trees. You know, it can be a variety. You can grow black locust for fence posts. Mm-hmm. You know, you can, whatever you want to do, and you need to protect them the first year or two from grazing animals so that they won't stomp on them and they won't eat them. But right. you can probably do that with a single electric wire over them. But they can also be grown in clumps, and they would have to be protected and maybe fenced. But the point is you want to have either shade rows or shade patches mm-hmm. for the animals, because whatever trees you grow are going to do something about lessening the amount of wind that comes through, and that will be a less of a stress on the animals, especially mm-hmm. in the summertime. And the shade, of course, again, in the summertime mm-hmm. will be very important. But they've shown that there really is significant differences in the weight gains of calves if you've got a cow-calf operation. And the animals are just generally healthier because they're less stressed. Hmm. And then, of course, those trees are going to be some kind of income mm-hmm. producer
value
for you.
As well. Huh.
So
you've got your forage,
sure.
and you've got your animals, and you've got a tree crop. And then the trees are doing all those neat things that we are now lumping under environmental services, which is holding the soil mm-hmm. and, you know, taking in carbon dioxide and, you know, all that good stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it makes sense.
Are you making progress?
Well, yeah, especially with the forest farming thing, which yeah. is my particular baby. I've been talking about this for 20 years, which is probably not unusual. And then suddenly everybody's saying, gee,
right.
that sounds like a really
exactly.
good idea. How do I do that?
It sounds like people would be more receptive to these things now than ever, huh?
Well, and part of that's the whole economic, the global economic scene.
Right.
And part of it is, you know, sustainability mm-hmm. and doing things locally mm-hmm. and organics and all of these things are, I think, I personally think this whole idea of agroforestry is getting to a tipping point where people are going to say, gee, this is something I'd really like to do with my land. How do mm-hmm. I go about doing it? And a lot of it's pretty straightforward. It's just
sure.
not that difficult to do.
Right.
And depending on which one you choose, it's more costly. But one of the reasons that I love the forest farming is I want people to walk their woods and see what they have
mm-hmm. yeah.
and see what they could build on that's already there. And we haven't even talked about crafts. I mean, are we the center of woodcraft in the United States or
yeah,
what?
Right.
Yeah.
And so funny-looking burls or peculiarly shaped branches, especially like my tulip popper, things that have been damaged by ice storms or whatever and have, you know, S-curves in them, or you've got a grapevine or something that's climbed up a young sapling and now you've got a spiral ridge up that piece of wood. You know, you can make walking sticks, you can make canes, you can make broom handles. You know, you can do all kinds of things with these things. So I'm trying to get people to open their eyes and say, walk your woods and see what you've got.
Well, you've certainly opened ours, and we appreciate
yes.
it.
Thank you, Deborah.
Oh, you're more than welcome.
Deborah Hill is an extension professor with the University of Kentucky's Department of Forestry. For more information on Deborah, the tulip poplar, or her work with the development of forestry-related farm commodities, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org.
Coming up, Alan Armitage on vines and climbers. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
With Bob Hill.
And on to vines and climbers.
We are.
Some different ones, too. And this, like, if you're really interested in vertical plants, you might want to purchase the book because there's some really, really cool stuff in here. It's inspired me to sort of break out of my little security zone in terms of what vines we know grow for us.
And Alan Armitage is a vertical kind of guy.
He sure is. And he's joining us
today. He's always taking off somewhere.
Alan Armitage is joining us now. He's likely the foremost herbaceous perennial plantsman in America. He's the author of a dozen books on annuals, perennials, cut flowers, and native plants, including the most recent, Armitage's Vines and Climbers, A Gardener's Guide to the Best Vertical Plants. And you know you're famous Bob, if your name's possessive in the title of a book.
Yeah.
He's been at the University of Georgia as a professor and researcher for about forever, I suspect, and he also runs the trial gardens there. We love having you on Homegrown, and this time around, it's to talk about Climbers and Vines, beautiful book published by Timber Press. It's a more unusual collection of vines and climbers than I've seen sort of compiled. So can you give us an idea of how you went about choosing what to include in the book?
I always like to write about things I know, which seems like a doesn't seem like such a stretch, but unfortunately it happens occasionally.
Yeah,
but
it can be. Actually.
And so running the trial gardens at the University of Georgia, I've been playing with vines for a long time. So nearly every vine in there, I've grown myself, or I certainly visited where I've seen these vines growing robustly at times, not so well at other times.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I tried to choose those I thought would be fun to talk about.
Okay, let's start with some of the basics then. Just kind of plain old green, you know? The I want to cover the ugly concrete wall or the fence. I can tell you one that, like, stuck out for me, the Stictocardia.
Oh, yeah.
It was fabulous.
It is sort of like a Dutchman's pipe vine, and then it has great big almost heart-shaped leaves, and it's great for even enclosing a porch.
Mm-hmm.
For the summertime where you get shade, you get privacy, and it has these gorgeous orange flowers that are to die for. They don't flower profusely like a clematis, for example, but they certainly are wonderful just at doing what they do.
Mm-hmm. Maybe we should, before we get into some other plants, Alan, maybe we should have a note about how the book is organized, because you've got a bunch of different types of vines included alphabetically, but also some of them are annual, some of them are perennial, some of them,
right,
you know, are considered tropical. So, of course, not all of them are going to be ideal for Kentuckiana, but all of that cultural information is there.
Right, and while I know it's important to somebody walking in the garden center and asking, is it annual or is it perennial? I mean, it's nice to know that, of course. But we have way too many people saying that if it's not perennial, I don't want it.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, that's their business. I don't really care. But the fact is that there are many, many vines, or annuals for that matter, that give you 6, 7, 8 months of great visual pleasure. But all of these vines, the tropicals or the annuals or the perennials, they all have a place.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is that people equate vines oftentimes with kudzu. And there are some awful vines out there. When you start asking yourself about the invasive plants out there, you know, English ivy and wisteria and kudzu, and they're all vines, and people sort of shy away from them. So sometimes having annual vines is not such a bad idea.
Well, and they seem to be such vigorous growers and such fabulous bloomers that it's worth only having them for that one season anyway.
You know, and it's fun. And let's face it, gardening has got to be fun.
Mm-hmm. So what's one of your favorite fast-growing annual vines that we might want to try up our way?
You know, I think some of the Dutchman's pipes are so much fun. There is a perennial Dutchman's pipe, of course, or native. But it's got small flowers and large leaves, and it's a great plant. But there's a number of Dutchman's pipes that don't really overwinter very well. They may come back, but you can usually just count them as annuals. But they have great, huge flowers and great, fun flower buds, large leaves. They're terrific. And there's the genus is Aristolochia. It's a big mouthful, but just Dutchman's pipe.
Mm-hmm.
And you can get seeds of that, and you can even get, certainly, depending on, you know, the kind of retailer you have near you or mail order, you can get these things fairly easily.
Mm-hmm.
There's a plant that's in the book called Momartica. It's a great thing. It's called bitter melon. It's actually a fruit.
It's fabulous.
It's actually a cucumber family.
Uh-huh. So describe it to our listeners in terms of the craziness of the fruit, the flower, the fruit,
and
the seed.
I'm not sure I can describe it well. it's a cucumber, okay, essentially. So, you know, it's going to grow pretty quickly. And it puts these warty green little cucumber things. They're not long and narrow. They're kind of football shaped. And then over time, they open. And they open into this just incredible red and yellow and seeds. And they're Stephen King of fruit. And actually, they're quite edible. They're bitter. That's where it gets its name, bitter melon. But they're quite edible. It's just a fun plant.
That's on a show.
And again, the little birds and insects kind of like it and all that other stuff.
Another one that appealed to me was the bleeding heart vine, the Dicentra scandens.
Isn't that fabulous?
Yeah. I had no idea there was a bleeding heart vine.
Well, you know, if this, if we still are friends at the end of this interview, I'll send you some.
Okay.
but it is, you know, most people know bleeding heart.
Sure.
Yeah.
You know, the red or the pink. But this is a yellow flowers. The foliage is not big. It does not hide the flowers. And it'll grow 6, 7, 8 feet in a year. Hmm. It actually comes back in zone 7. But, you know, where you are, it'd be real marginal.
Right.
But if you protect it, it would come back, maybe. But nevertheless, again, it looks just like a bleeding heart,
mm-hmm.
but it's yellow, and it climbs.
Hmm.
And I like putting that, and again, those listeners saying, Jay, well, what do I put vines? What do I do with the darn things? I think one of the limitations of gardeners and vines is, gee, I have to have a trellis, or I have to have some pergola or something. You don't really. Some of these things, like bleeding heart vine, will climb right through some of Bob's weird shrubs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, what is the use of
exactly,
a shrub except
yeah.
to put a vine through? but they will. They really do well just growing through natural vegetation.
Mm-hmm. Well, and why couldn't you use it as a ground cover in some form or
you
fashion?
You could. If you don't
even.
Let it climb, it has little tendrils,
mm-hmm.
so it will attach itself to things.
Mm-hmm.
But if you don't have any place to climb, it'll just... your ground cover.
Hmm. Now, let's talk shade a little bit, either perennials or annuals, because I get asked about once a week. I've got this shady area. I want to put a vine in here. And
mm-hmm.
what do you recommend for shade?
Well, again, if you're looking for a vine with lot, well, it depends. Again, shade is difficult to
right.
really describe. But if
yeah.
it's really heavy shade, you really have to use something that's really grown for the foliage.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And again, you know, parthenocissus, etc. Do just fine in shade.
Virginia
another
creeper.
Another neat plant that your listeners should try, and again you should look at, is one called the Rex Begonia vine.
Oh huh. Wow!
It's got a great name.
Yeah.
It's called Cissus, C-I-S-S-U-S.
I saw that.
And it's in the grape family, but it doesn't put any flowers out to speak of.
Mm-hmm.
But it's fabulous foliage. I mean, and it tolerates shade. You know, the deeper the shade, the harder it is. But certainly afternoon shade is not a problem for any of these plants. But Rex Begonia just puts out this spectacular foliage. It's kind of green with silver and a little pink. And we put it on chicken wire, believe it or not, and it just goes right up the chicken wire fence.
Huh.
Yeah, and the Cissus is a beautiful green and silver variegation. It's phenomenal.
Isn't it amazing?
Yeah.
So it's not a Rex Begonia, but it essentially looks like some of the foliage from some of the Rex Begonias.
I think somebody named it because of the foliage, you know,
right.
all those kind of...
That'll give
colorful foliage on the Rex Begonia.
Mm-hmm. So, Alan, let me ask you about some of the more unusual clematis, because so often people, okay, they know Jack Manny or they know the traditional large flowering, but I'm in love with the smaller bell-shaped dangling varieties, and, you know, those need to be a little bit more mainstream, perhaps, than what people realize.
There are some that I really think are terrific, particularly if you live in an area with warm, hot summers,
mm-hmm.
which we both do.
That's us, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Texas clematis, Clematis texensis.
Yeah, I love that.
You know, it has. If you get the specie is not very vigorous.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I would recommend it for you as a gardener, but I wouldn't recommend it if I was going to do a job for somebody,
mm-hmm.
because the flowers are small. They're deep lipstick red, but they're not terribly vigorous. They're not floriferous, but the cultivars of the Texas clematis, like Princess Diana and like Duchess of Albany, those are no brainers. And in our heat, and they just go right through, and they overwinter just fine. And so those are some of the specie types. We do some of the native ones, Viorna and a few others, and they do just fine. But again, they're not sexy like some of these others. And for the gardener who just doesn't know what to get, you know, the pictures of a hybrid clematis are hard to resist, but there are some excellent other ones out there than just a big hybrids.
Yeah.
One of my favorites is one called Rigucci, and that's in there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a blue kind of bell-shaped, and it does very, very well for us.
Yeah, and then there's the climbing hydrangeas. It's kind of an old favorite with me, but talk about the different cultivars and the use of those
guys. You've got, you know, this is good. Now, you're going to be very proud of me, Bob. You know, I put woody stuff in here as much as I could.
Oh, my God.
You know, I did it. I mean, you know, climbing hydrangeas, skies of fire. Yeah. I put a bunch of woody stuff in there. And, of course, there's not very much woody stuff because being woodies, they don't know that they're allowed to climb. But I had to put our native wisteria, of course, which is a terrific plant. I stay away from the other stuff. But the climbing hydrangea, the true climbing hydrangea, which is Hydrangea anomala, T. dialaris, that's just a fabulous plant. And again, if it grows well for you, and the easiest way to know sometimes if it grows well for you in a given area, if you've never grown it yourself, is obviously ask a gardener, ask you guys, ask extension people whether they see climbing hydrangeas around.
Mm-hmm.
The Skies of Phragma, another fabulous quote-unquote climbing hydrangea.
Right.
I like that even better than the hydrangea genus.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then, of course, the third climbing hydrangea is one called Decumaria, which does very well the further south you go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
there's some choices for sure in a climbing hydrangea. I love the first two, the hydrangea and the Skies of Phragma.
Yeah, the Skies of Phragma, I think it's Moon Glow or Moonlight, has a beautiful silver-gray leaf. It's incredible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And those are, and again, if you see those growing, you I don't know how much hydrangea, climbing hydrangea has grown in Louisville, but
quite a bit, in fact.
Yeah, they can be very aggressive.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And both of those can, actually.
It seems, Bob and I have this joke that you have to wait 7 years. They're kind of pokey slow, and then once that 7-year itch mark occurs, then all of a sudden they take off. And it's literally almost true in every instance.
Yeah, I think that's true.
Yeah,
I think that's true with a lot of these plants.
So, Alan, what are my chances? Because I want to try some things that are really different that I've never tried before, and I think most of it's going to be the annual avenue as you talked. But wait, here's the one that I want you to tell me if I've got good odds growing.
Okay.
Rhodochiton.
Oh, rhodochiton.
Rhodochiton.
Yeah, that's actually, I won't say easy to find, but reasonably easy to find.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it's not really aggressive. I would put it up a pole, or I'd put it up somewhere in your patio, a post. It's probably not going to get more than, for you, 5 feet maybe, maybe a little bit more. And it has these wonderful, if you look at those purple flowers, almost hose and hose flowers.
Yeah.
They're very, very pretty. If you can, you know, I don't think it's going to overwinter. You can mulch the heck out of it, but if you could get it over a winter or bring it in, then it would grow even higher the next year.
Mm-hmm.
But its first year is probably going to be 5 to 7 feet.
Okay, what were you going to tell me to grow?
Oh, I was going to tell you to try this plant called butterfly plant, which is called Mascagnia.
Is that
Mascagnia, Mascagnia. No, we haven't heard of it.
Okay.
But it has these pretty, pretty, kind of frilly yellow flowers, and then it puts on fruit that just looked like great big butterflies. I mean, big butterflies. It's a pretty vine. Again, it's not aggressive. It grows reasonably quickly. And a lot of these kind of annual vines, many of them, they have to grow in order to flower, so most of them are not going to flower till midsummer, late summer, or fall, which is not a bad thing.
You're on. I'll grow it.
and there's a lilac one as well with lilac flowers, but I love the yellow one.
Mascagnia.
Mascagnia. I think it's butterfly plant or something.
But the prettiest flower, bar none, is the Tweedia.
It is the bluest of the blue.
Exactly.
It really is. It has great attributes. You need to get some seed probably from a vine grower or somebody, because some tend to be more viney than others.
Mm-hmm.
But if you read it, I hope I said there's a couple of problems with it. One is it's in the milkweed family.
Yeah, it dies.
It
you mentioned
weed, which is not such a bad thing, but also it kind of smells bad. But who cares?
That blue is worth anything, man. It's incredible.
All right,
blue.
So Bob, you try to grow that, and I'll grow the butterfly plant.
Oh my goodness! Yeah.
All right, Alan, thank you so much for your time. We appreciate it as always, and the book is beautiful.
Well, thank you, and I look forward to seeing you both.
All right. Alan Armitage is a University of Georgia professor and researcher and the author of Armitage's Vines and Climbers, A Gardener's Guide to the Best Vertical Plants, published by Timber Press. Of course, if you'd like more information, you can go to our website at wfpl.org.
Coming up next, a few listener questions and Miss Wishy's new Latin Word of the Week. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL.
Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
Bob Hill.
And we've got a couple questions, Bob. And
yep.
I'm going to ask you this one because I know you've got some experience in it. It's
I
from
do.
Mike. And he says that he intends to do some air layering.
Right.
And he actually has tried, you know, some from several from the same tree. And he's found what seems to be straightforward instructions.
Mm-hmm.
But nowhere does it say if the plant should or should not be leafed out. Can you tell me? So I think optimum time at which he should do this is the question.
Air layering, basically, and I've done this successfully, which kind of amazed me, is that you'll take the root of a plant or even the little benign small stem of a plant, put it underground, kind of cut a little bit, put a brick on it,
mm-hmm.
and let it root. Then you cut it off between the mother plant and the root, and there you got your baby plant. And you can really do it. I mean, the plant has to be growing, but early spring is a good time to do it. Early to mid-spring.
That's the optimum time.
That's the best time to do it because that's when the plant's cranking up and getting ready to go.
Mm-hmm.
When it's most likely to set the new roots, but it's kind of fun to do.
Yeah. So I don't think ultimately, like, it matters if it's still hasn't budded
leaves.
Out completely
or if it
already has, but just that springtime time frame is probably more ideal than, you know, some other time of the year.
Because the roots are cranking up before the leaves really come on.
So. If it's actively growing, it'll actively, you know, put out roots where you've wounded it. So I don't think that's going to matter as much.
All right, one for Miss Wishy from Barbara.
Mm-hmm.
Several weeks ago, you talked about camellias that would work in Zone 6, which is us. Can you let me know what species will grow here? I lost a place in Biloxi in Katrina and miss camellia blossoms most of all. She's in Bardstown now.
All right, and let's see. I think we were on State of Affairs talking about hardy camellias.
Yeah.
And there are a whole selection of hardy camellias that are a cross between two different species.
They've been bred to be hardy.
And they've been bred to be hardy by a man named William Ackerman.
Yep.
And most of the names suggest
some
sort of
winter.
Cold, frosty winter sort of thing. So, for example, Winter's Dream, Snow Flurry, Frost Princess, Polar Ice are some that suggest that hardiness.
Yeah, I've met some Frost Princesses in my day,
too. Yeah, me too. So, essentially, down in Bardstown, I would go to your local nurseries, and they would, if they're small, reputable nurseries, really only carry these hardy varieties for you. If you can't find them at your local nurseries, you can find them through mail order, but just look for the Ackerman hardy camellia varieties, and those snowy names will suggest further hardiness.
Yep, and they still need like a protected site and the rest of it, but they're worth
trying. All right, here's another one from Lindsay. Do you know of any nurseries around Louisville that carry Chinese viburnum? I saw a picture of one online and thought it was absolutely beautiful, but I haven't seen any around town as far as I know. Would they do well here? And she wants to make sure if they're pet friendly, you know, and non-toxic, if her dogs happen to ingest any. So the Chinese viburnum is Viburnum macrocephalum, big head, or snowball, right?
Yes, and it's a fabulous plant. I've had them for years, and they're just a really neat plant. They're heavily bloomed, and they can have flowers the size of a softball or bigger if you prune them back. And yes, they are available. They're not that hard to find.
No, they aren't. You should be able to find
them.
And
go to any nursery and say you want the big head viburnum.
Mm-hmm.
You can get it.
Macrocephalum means big head.
Yeah, and I don't think, I don't think that dogs are going to be affected by eating a big head viburnum.
I've never heard of any toxicity issues related to viburnum, no.
No.
Yeah. All right.
So you're good to go.
Yes, and if you have a question, you can get a hold of us in various ways.
Visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org, email us at homegrown@WFPL.org, or call us at 502-814-8246. Miss Wishy, for a really, really big show we've had today, a really great show, what would your Latin word be?
This one surprised me. Speciosus, speciosa, or speciosum.
It's counterintuitive.
It is totally counterintuitive.
Yeah.
It means showy.
Yeah, it sounds like it'd be very specific.
And like kind of plain Jane.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, well, that's just the species.
Yeah, I don't like that one. There's nothing showy about that
one. Right. So, but in fact, speciosus means showy.
Yeah.
So, for example, Catalpa speciosus. Think how showy the catalpa tree is when it blooms.
Love it or hate it.
Oh, my Lord.
Yeah.
It is super showy.
Yeah.
Solidago speciosa.
The showy goldenrod.
Showy goldenrod.
Man.
Asclepias speciosa.
The showy milkweed.
Showy milkweed.
There's a pattern here.
Onethra speciosa.
The pink evening primrose or pink ladies.
And Lilium speciosum.
The Japanese lily. Well, you talk about showy.
Yeah.
So, that is counterintuitive.
Yeah, it totally is. So that's, a good little Latin word to understand the true meaning be surprised.
We blame Linnaeus? Who do we blame for this?
I think maybe Linnaeus, yeah.
Well, he never did know anything.
Well, now we've been enlightened, so we're all right. All right, well, that ends another edition of Homegrown. Next week on the show, did you know that one of the top-rated climbers in arboriculture is a woman? Josephine Hedger, yes. She's visiting Louisville from England next week, and we'll have a chance to chat with her.
Homegrown is produced by the very showy Brad Yost in the studios of WFPL. I'm nondescript Bob Hill.
And I'm Janine Wishy. Join us next week for Homegrown on WFPL.